in 1918, he actually came up with the idea for the Believe It or Not cartoon. And it was it happened one night. He was in a hurry to leave. He was up against a wall to try to come up with an illustration for the day. And he pulled out a file out of his desk drawer that he'd been keeping for many years called Dubious Athletic Achievements. And he'd been collecting these little, believe it or not, as they turned out to be, items about baseball players and just sports in general. And he combined nine of them on one sheet, something he had never done before. He knew he was going to catch all kinds of dickens because he did it, because it was so different from everything
right.
he'd ever done. Tossed it on his editor's desk and just went on out, thinking that, okay, well, I can deal with this the trouble that I'm creating
in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. And he came in, and you would have thought the guy invented sliced bread. There were telegrams from all over New York. People were just excited. You know, this is great. This is fantastic. So he got away with that one, and for a couple times a month, a week, and then to daily. It just kind of went in slowly by slowly until it really became a daily cartoon. And he started syndicating in the New York and the East Coast area.
Was he starting to make money, Tim, when he was syndicating his cartoons?
Well, he wasn't really making a lot of money, because when William Randolph Hearst got a hold of Rip in 1929, this would have been 10 years later, he still had fewer than 20 publications that had syndicated his cartoon strip. And so when he got into the big syndicate with William Randolph Hearst and actually had his first book published in 1929, it really caught on, and at his peak, he had something like 80 million people reading his comic
wow.
every day.
It was the books, though, that really got him going, wasn't it?
Well, not really.
Really?
It kept him going. But what he did was that first book he published, again, it was Hearst's idea, saying, hey, this is a, you've got something going here. So they put the book out, and this was in 1929, remember. And by the time the book really quit selling in the mid-30s, it had sold 3 million copies. And that was during the Depression.
That's huge.
It was very huge back then. So that just, you know, Ripley was really a superstar, a media superstar, a media darling. And by 1936, believe it or not, he was voted the most popular man in America, even more so than Roosevelt.
And he was doing radio, right?
Yeah.
Eventually?
He started radio. He spent more than 14 years on radio, and he really became a pioneer, not only with the Believe It or Not, but just the way he handled radio in general. He did a lot of on-site. He was the first one to broadcast around the world. He was the first one to broadcast from Europe to America. He was the first one to do a lot of different aspects of live radio. He was the first one to actually broadcast live from the bottom of a shark tank at Marineland.
When did he start getting strange and bizarre?
You know, I don't think that's documented, but I would expect that it probably started when he was born, you know.
I was going to say, what happened to him?
Yeah, that would be kind of interesting to find out. He always was a little eccentric. One of his friends had once said that it looks like a bunch of paint cans exploded in his closet, because he wore really real colorful clothing, and he wore the white spats on his shoes, and
always a hat, right?
Always a hat, whether it be a fedora. Later in his life, he wore a pith helmet along with his suit and tie.
And somebody said that he had beaver teeth. Is that true?
Well, he had buck teeth. I don't know if they were, I guess Bucky Beaver came.
That's what I heard. They used to call him beaver teeth.
Yeah, he was. I don't know if he was ever called that or not, but he did have buck teeth. And he was quite the bachelor. that's a part of his life that I really dig. You know, the guy had he was married briefly in 1919.
No offspring that you know of, right?
None that we know of.
All right.
He had a very short marriage with a Ziegfeld Follies dancer, and they separated after 3 months, and then they finally got a divorce after 3 years. But he was very fascinated with the social life. He was as he was becoming more and more popular and well known, he was absolutely on the A-list in New York.
So he enjoyed life.
Very much so. Very much so. And all you have to do is look at some of these film clips of him traveling the world in the 20s and 30s. And the guy was just, always had a smile on his face and just really loved life.
Was he a nice guy? Did you ever hear any reports from people that, you know, didn't like him, thought he was arrogant? Because everything I've read, the world loved the guy.
He was. He was kind of like an American Idol. people really looked up to him. He had lecture tours. And, you know, when he would leave the United States to go on his trips overseas, he would leave from the ships there in New York Harbor. And the newsreel crews would be out there. There'd be big crowds. The papers would announce in the morning that Ripley was leaving town. And they would all go say goodbye to him. And likewise, when he would come back, they would be waiting for him, wanting to know what kind of rarities and oddities he brought back from those world travels. And a lot of people lived vicariously through the travels that Rip did.
Tim, was he a little like P.T. Barnum, a showman who, you know, as you say, was looking for different things and exhibits? You know, P.T. was one of the best, but sounds like that Mr. Ripley was about the same.
He was, absolutely. And in 1933, at the Chicago World's Fair, Ripley had his first public exhibit, a lot of the rarities that he had collected through the years. And it was compared, of course, with the dime museums and the American Museum that Barnum had in New York City back in the 1800s. And the over a year's period, the Oddatorium, Robert Ripley's, believe it or not, Oddatorium.
I love that name.
Yeah, isn't that great?
I love it.
attracted 3 million people. It was the number one exhibit at the Chicago World's Fair. And here's something that's really cool. Today, we're kind of jaded. We can kind of understand the weirdness. And we are satiated our curiosity so many times, things are really hard to surprise us. But back when he opened the auditorium in 1933, he actually had nurses and I think six cots right there at the exhibit for the people who fainted.
They just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, exactly.